are on the move from the nonsense into the good sense. This is Mike Africa Jr. and this is the On the Move podcast here on the Black Love Podcast Network. And we are here to illuminate the struggles of the people, inform the uninformed, and give you nothing but the truth. On the Move is here to disrupt the system and spark a global revolutionary change. The change is what we need. Like Sam Cooke said, a change is going to come. But like Gandhi said, you got to be the change you want to see in the world. And even though Gandhi wasn't perfect, he said something that was true. And when the power of truth is present, you better respect it. So, yo, check this out, y'all. I'm hyped today, y'all. I've been wanting to talk to a lot of people, but this guy right here done said some things. He done some really special things, and we about to learn something today. Everybody about to learn something today. So here we go. Check this out. This guy is an award-winning educator, a recording artist, a father, and a husband, and a fellow podcaster right here on the Black Love Podcast Network. But fun fact, check this out. This brother just recently opened for Erykah Badu. What? Pay attention to my brother from another mother, Kariga Bailey. What's up, bro? How you feel?
Big love. I'm well, man. I'm present. I'm well. I'm grateful. Got all I need. What's going on with you, man?
Man, listen, when people ask me how I'm doing, I'll be like, it's hard to be better. Like, I'm just like, I got so much good things going on in my life. My mom, my dad is home after 40 years in prison. My kids are healthy. My wife is great. We've been together 24 plus years. It's just real good. So I feel you on that one, bro. But look, check this out. So before we get into some really like heavy stuff, we always do this thing called Gimme Two. Activists are multifaceted. Sometimes people don't think of us as doing anything other than protesting and rallying. So Gimme Two is a way to spotlight the other good things we got going on in our lives. So I want us to share like two good things that made us smile this week. So I'll go first. So I had a dinner date with some friends of mine. They came over yesterday and we discovered this new game. It's a card game that shows, and it's something about black card, right? So if you ask all of these questions, then when it's all over, when it's all said and done, if you lose points, too many points, you lose your black card. And I'm proud to say that I didn't lose my black card.
Big up.
It's just like crazy questions. Like if you could take all these things off of a menu, right? All these things off of a menu, what would you take off? Would it be salty foods? Would it be overcooked collard greens? Would it be fried chicken? Or would it be like, you know, all of these different things? And yo, I got to say, man, I did well on the blacklist. I'm proud of that.
They can't revoke your black card, man.
They be trying, bro. They say, yo, Mike, you done hung out with HBO people. You done lost your black card.
Cold game.
They don't know what they talking about. The other thing that happened to me that was really cool, though, I dropped my daughter off at school. You know, she's 10 years old, right? And I noticed that the way the school is structured and the kids, the friends that she's like picking up, she's growing up right before my eyes, and I'm feeling good about it. Like, I'm one of those dads that it's hard to let go of my kids. And she's the youngest and my boys are grown. I thought I was going to feel kind of like sad about it, but I'm proud of myself that I feel good about her getting older and this process. She has these friends and she's like, Dad, no, I can't do that with you right now. I'm hanging out right now with so-and-so. That's the like look she gave me. And she wanted to talk to her friend Angel for a couple minutes before she came with me. So, but I felt good about it. I was happy to see. What you got?
Man, I want to acknowledge the complexities of what you shared around your baby girl and that chapter of independence and, you know, and them doing what they want to do for themselves. I'm on a different spectrum. What brings me joy, however, is my daughter and her newfound independence. So watching her make choices, right? Going from infant to toddler stage, but watching her make choices brings me such joy because it, you know, it reminds me that this is her. She's a whole person. I'm coming to know her, but I love to see her personality shine through. You know, we used to just observe physical features or how they're growing, but getting to know her personality brings me great joy. So my daughter getting to know her personality, and another thing that caused a great smile, we took a road trip down the Route 1 and took it out to Monterey, Carmel area and got to see some sunsets over there. And, you know, I've never done that before. So that was a great smile.
Kids and hanging out and all of that is real good. And listen, I know people have told you this, but enjoy it while it lasts because it goes fast.
True that.
I'm 43. My son is 23, man. He was just a baby, a toddler, 20 minutes ago. Bro.
Oh, wow.
So let me tell you, man, a lot of people know about your story, right? A lot of people don't know about your story, too, though. Give me a minute rundown of who you are.
I'm Kariga Bailey. My name means chosen for truth. and rebel. And I've come to live out those findings, like beyond what somebody names me and what I was told. I have come to study love deeply and intimately. The intersection that really taught me most about love was grief. Grief taught me empathy in greater details, made me reflect on my career as a public servant, as an educator, as an artist, a storyteller. Yeah, I'm a storyteller. I shift the world around me and my world with words. I think even in some of my career assignments, it was always doing the same thing. It was shifting worlds with words and action and deed and follow through. But yeah, man, I am a father, artist, educator, multidimensional being.
You know, listening to you talk about grief, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how that has like shaped and cultivated this love, man. Like listening to your podcast with your wife, Felicia, it is so intimate and touching, man. And like, I don't know if everybody else feel the same way that I feel, but when I listen to it, I'm just like drawn to it. And I can just feel it's like a gravitational pull that just like pulls me into understanding deeply, you know, what you're talking about. And it makes me wonder the grief and all of that, but that just like opened up already who you are.
Mm-hmm.
The work that you do in education,
mm-hmm.
do you think that helped that heart that you have? Do you think that helped with the education that you do for people, for your kids?
You know, it's unique you should ask that. Without a doubt, it was one of the challenges I faced in some of the training situations or recruiting situations. Just to define it, right? So my background in education is special education. Okay. I went and got a master's in special education. I taught in Southeast DC and then became a dean in the school systems out there. And then came to Oakland and opened a school in Oakland. And I remember in the recruiting phase and in the training phase, I was able to start more singularly identifying what are the most salient factors we're looking for. And it wasn't your certification. It wasn't your teaching experience. The essential question I began asking is, who are you when you're offended? Right. Because the educator I was looking for was someone who's self-aware enough to know that when they experience offense, they're going to have to train themselves with a different set of responses. Because in that instance, the dynamic is, it is imbalanced, right? You're an adult and that's a child. And any minute you can exact a level of adult supremacy, we call it, where the adult is always inherently right, right? And in that dynamic, a young person is, you can push them out the institution, but the personal dynamic is so important. So does my heart shape the educator I am and the work I do? Absolutely. Absolutely. We have to ask ourselves, right? How do we love what challenges us? How do we love what challenges us? And the work in education, at least as I've seen it, is that reoccurring question on a daily basis, sending you deeper into your praxis. We can show you who we are on a resume, but that doesn't tell me who you are when you're offended.
How do we love what challenges us?
For real.
Break that down, bro. Like, yeah. What does that mean?
All right. So when we are in preparation to become educators or into the classroom, you know, you can have all types of motives of what brings you there and the impact you desire to have when you're there. But being an educator is set up in such a way that you won't just impact their lives. You have to open up to the possibility of them impacting your life. It is, no one comes to save. You don't get I don't care what your background is or how many years you have, you don't save anybody. So the thing is, you have to become available for the learning dynamic, and students learn best when they feel safe. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when I'm talking about loving what challenges you, if the student challenges you and you in response can't love them with challenging you, they'll never feel safe in your classroom. But consequently, you'll be creating a reality for yourself in which you're always tested in the same way, because your response, it controls for that. All right, check. So look, I used to work in group homes and I did counseling in juvenile detention centers in downtown Newport News, right? So it's back in my VA days. Okay. And one of the young people that I was a counselor for told me in these very certain terms, I never forget, I was probably no older than 20. And he said, I can't control much in here. I don't control when I eat. I don't control when I get up. I don't control when I shower. But if I'm real intentional, I can control how the guard treats his family when he goes home. I said, what you mean? He said, based on what type of day he has here. So if this day is nothing but challenging for him, it's going to impact it, because we hear about it in some way or another. When he comes back to work, he talks about what happens. And when I realized that the dynamic was set up in such a way where young people could deeply impact who we were, who we thought we were, how we cope with that reality, then I realized, oh, we have to show up differently. So if a young person doesn't feel safe in your space, they will constantly create a dynamic, an occurrence in which someone else is going to be uncomfortable in that space. It can be another classmate, but in most instances, it's going to be the teacher. I'm uncomfortable, so you're uncomfortable.
I was listening to your show, Soul Affirmation.
Uh-huh.
And you told a story about the laptop incident, right?
Yeah.
And you, the reason I bring that up is because it makes me think about kids in school. And I'm trying to get to a certain point about children and their education and what's happening in this country with them. So you want to tell that story for the audience?
Would you mind helping me understand? So I'm in my mind, in my practice, I'm thinking of two personal experiences with my laptop. Now, there was one that inspired a poem where the young person didn't care about my laptop. And it is another story where I had to go into the hood in Southeast and recover my laptop. So which one is it?
Say, hold on, yo, homie.
I'm telling you the truth. I had to go. I'm gonna give you two quick ones. The first one is an incident where I was asking the young person to watch out for my laptop, and he turned to me very intentionally, without blinking an eye, and said, "How am I supposed to care about your laptop when I don't care about myself?"
Right. That's the one that I wanted you to tell, because it brings me to this question about the way the children are being educated in this country,
mm-hmm.
right? And I want you to tell the other one too, but mm-hmm. I want to get to that part of it first, because one thing that gets me is that when we're talking about these kids who are making these kind of statements, it seems like it's always black kids,
mm-hmm.
poor kids, people that are not being understood, they're not being properly cared for. There's this educational gap between our kids and how they're being taught when they're coming from these poorer communities, and education is not prioritized in the way that it should
be. Mm-hmm.
So that's why I wanted you to tell that. And when you see this kind of reaction from this kid, you could describe what this kid was like.
King, I want to first acknowledge that I appreciate the space to provide clarity on this, but I think in my own understanding, my own clarity, I wouldn't doubt that these experiences don't exist in other spaces with other students from other nationalities. My experiences aren't set up in a way as such where I've got to know that and experience that, right? The majority of my teaching experience were black children. And then when I came to Oakland, black and brown children. But I think that the apathy that he described was a necessary teaching moment for me. But I also think that the messaging of him not caring about himself isn't only because of what's happening in school. Whether you're describing poor communities or spaces, right? I'm also intentional not to call these at-risk children, because these are placed at-risk children, right? Somebody designed a risk and then placed them in that risk. Poverty is a design. We know that. It doesn't have to exist. It exists by design. And in fact, poverty is big business. So when a young person is receiving messaging over and over again that they are lesser important, that their outcomes are less important, that their priorities or their options in life are less important, it is very easy to see how they can have that positionality having nothing to do with school exclusively. But when school reinforces that you need to be a certain way in order to be here or you can't be here, it only reinforces the messaging they receive around not being valued in spaces. So the challenge that I frame for myself is, how do I hear that and set up my teaching and learning in a way that seeks to learn more about him, that seeks to prioritize knowing more about him or why he feels that way, or creating the opportunity to be present, because presence is profound. Maybe you can build some relationship out of just choosing to be around this person. But why would I choose to be around somebody who challenges me, right? And I'm not saying I always wanted to be around this student. Right. I'm not saying I always wanted to be around this student. But one of my favorite anecdotes about this particular student is years later, when he found out how relentless my love was, and he saw the difference between how I showed up in a longitudinal way versus how other people has. You know, he could still find me 4 and 5 years after he was in my class. And mm-hmm. I had just written a book at the time that accompanied the album. It was called Surrender, a Poetic Ethnography. And he said he heard about the book when he was on the inside, that I was still teaching, still writing. So I picked him up one weekend when he came home and we was chilling. We went to the car wash and I gave him a copy of the early draft. And my favorite thing about him was that he found a typo in my book, right? He found this same person who told me he didn't care about himself. I loved it. I thanked him for finding that typo. I thanked him for caring enough and reading it with enough intentionality. But also, I wanted to highlight for him that the moment had come where it was time for him to teach me. Because mm-hmm. life is a long road, right? And I'm at an age where some of my mentors or former employers or former supervisors, we coexist in the world as adults, as we co-investigate problem solving. Mm-hmm. The hierarchy isn't real anymore. And that's something for all educators to know. The hierarchy ain't real.
You know, listening to you talk about this, it reminds me of an acronym for the word respect. A friend of mine, the great Grizzly, he says, respect stands for remember everybody suffers painful experiences. Communicate tenderly.
That's a bar.
Your student. That's a bar, right? That, yeah. When he hit me with that joint, I was like, yo, I'm using it. Make sure I say your name on the joint so people know I ain't plagiarizing. But it just resonated with me, man. So listening to you talk about how you're learning from your students. And look, you the best kind of teachers for me. When I was growing up in Philly, the best kind of teachers for me were the ones that I could access beyond the school hours.
Yep.
Teachers that came to school just to do their job and get their paycheck at the end of 2 weeks, you know, whatever. Okay, thanks for the education. But
yeah, but those are magic genies.
I got to.
Because, bro, they appear at a bell and disappear at a bell. You be like, where are you really at, though? I don't know. You don't know me. You don't know nothing about where I come from. I don't see you. Yeah, you a genie.
Yo, that's exactly what it was like. I got my fifth grade school teacher, Miss Washington. She was the best, bro. I could call her on the phone and be like, hey, Miss Washington, I'm trying to figure out problem number C. And you, like, you told me this, that, and the other. And she'd be like, Michael, you know this stuff. You're just being crazy. Let me tell you what it is. And she would, like, work it out with me at 5 o'clock. She having dinner with her family. But you're teaching the heart that I hear and the interest. So you connected with the students in a way that I didn't find most teachers to connect with me. And then you took it like five steps further when you started connecting to the students around music.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
The music came about in the very first way. I was a dean and I was in charge of Saturday school. Okay. My weekends were notoriously mine for pursuing my passion. So I'd be writing rhymes or different things throughout the week. And the first one was a song called Roses. And I made note of the lives that were around me and how much attention I was paying to them and why they mattered. And I decided to shoot a video at the school. I was shooting the video after Saturday school. Saturday school was often for challenges or unfavorable behavior throughout the week. But anybody who was actually also like truant or tardy, man, we had so many young people stay at Saturday school. And ones who did not come to school all week came to Saturday school because they heard I was shooting a video. Right. And I realized that this was something that would catch attention. So I went and got a grant from the Pollination Project to have a recording studio after school in like a narrative therapy creative writing program. So I funded bringing a mobile studio to the school and we were recording the Maya Angelou Public Charter mixtape. And we're going to call it Rebel Music because that was the school mascot. So during this time, too, we also wrote our very first school song. The school did not have a song. A student who spent most time in my office for unfavorable behavior was also a very gifted musician. And with direction, he not only recruited other young people, but just really took charge of that whole program. We wrote a school song. And we had a number of other young people who were able to come and record. The only prerequisite was you had to go to your classes, right? In order to come record. And then we moved the prerequisite from going to your classes to, all right, if it involves writing, you got to get that work done because I don't understand how you can come here and write all this if you can't write in this space. But they only let you challenge them when you built that relationship around investment. On the day that we were listening to the project, it was supposed to be the listening day, I got a call that my older brother was shot and killed in Sacramento. And I give you this for context because this is when I learned a new thing from my students. I name often and frequently my students were my first grief mentors. They were the first ones. They were the very first respondent, the closest people to me when I got the call. And they had been mentoring me all along through their grief, through their memorialization process, through their pain, through their unanswered questions. So we became close differently in 2014. And that's when I really learned how interdependent we were. So that experience, what the high schoolers were able to do for me in 2014, informed what I thought young people can do, be, feel, comprehend moving forward. And when I was asked to come open the school in Oakland, we were going to be K-5. And one of my young people told me in D.C., like, damn, dog, I could really use you right now. Like having you in a school was one thing, but having you for life outside of school is when I really knew how much I needed you. But if it's between me and a youngin' out in Oakland, go get him now, Bailey. He told me, go get him now because you can't afford to always wait.
Listening to you talk about your brother and the students, mm-hmm. first grief counselors, I can only imagine that experience. If you wouldn't mind, I would love for you to tell us what that looked like at that time. What are some of the details of how they counseled you in that moment?
Well, the very first moment, I didn't say anything that happened. One student who worked closest with me, Trayvon, read my body language because of his experiences with getting that phone call. And if anybody's gotten that phone call, you know the very distinct things that are occurring. He read my body language and ushered all the other students out of my office. And he hugged me as tight as he could, only to stop me from collapsing. He didn't tell me what to do, what to feel. He just held me, didn't say much. And then the day, maybe like 2 days after, he called and he distinctly said, "I'm just calling to tell you I love you. You don't got to explain anything. You don't got to tell me how you feeling." So I was met with a different level of grace.
That emotion, that power from Trayvon, big up to Trayvon. I don't know if they say big up anymore. We say
no, I still say big up. They still get that from me.
Big up to Trayvon, man. That is so powerful. Wherever you are, bro, like, I thank you for that. You know, look, we could talk all day long, but before we go, bro, you got to tell me that other story about that laptop that you had to get recovered.
All right, so boom. All right, so boom. This is
I had to move from that, nah, G, that moment because
it all connects. Word to me, it all connects. Word to me, it all connects.
Okay.
So this is in my teaching days. I'm not a dean at the point. I'm still teaching. My laptop is critical to everything I do on the day to day basis. At this time, I'm also a full time grad student. Right. I'm a full time grad student at George Mason, and I need my laptop. I need it. And somebody got me. Right. Somebody got me for my laptop. By this time, I had earned a lot of respect with the students, with the parents, with everybody in the community. So somebody getting Bailey for his laptop, they call me Bailey, by the way, only Bailey, not Mr. or nothing else. They call my name like a CEO. So when they found out that my laptop, I got for my laptop, nobody was cool with it. They were like, nah, we're going to find out who it is. We're going to find out who it is. And like 98% of me want to be like, yeah, find out who it is. And whatever happened, happened. But the other 2% was like, they're going to stomp a mud hole in somebody, right? They're going to stomp a mud hole in some. So I looked at the security footage and I found out who got my laptop. And I jump in my Acura. I had an Acura 3.2 TL at the time. I drove that thing like a NASCAR.
And you was proud of it too, I can tell.
Boy, that was my graduation present from undergrad. So I had an Acura and I'm bawling down the way. And now the school police officer, the school resource officer is on my tail, right? Because he don't want me going into the hood and doing anything crazy. But I'm like, bro, I'm in grad school. I'm getting that laptop. So I'm driving to Southeast. I pull up in the hood and I see him. I knock the front door and the school resource officer is with me. And I hear footsteps in the house and I hear the back door open. So I run around the back door to find bruh trying to run out the house, right? So this is, I'm young Bailey at the time. So I got it, right? I'm hopping fences, this whatever. I want to answer where the laptop is. He gonna tell me he don't got it no more. I'm like, how you get rid of it already? You didn't sell it that quick. So his mom got wind. She's like, he don't have no laptop. And we show him the printout of the camera. Like, no, he took the laptop. And bro, it turned into one of the most painful witnesses of harmful behavior. Not because the mom was abusive in a way. He did not mind bringing shame to her doorstep because of how he felt about her. And when she was so frustrated for his lack of disregard, that caused more embarrassment for her as her child has just harmed a teacher and the school resource officer is there. You know, she just start telling him more things about himself that would reinforce he's not important. And I am not invalidating her love as a mother, but I saw what it looked like for a mother to be challenged and hurt by her child's behavior. And in return, try to hurt him because of his behavior. And his whole position was to drive that morale down low, to show his mom he don't care, to show his mom he gonna do what he wanna do. And I end up intervening in a way that really asked for her mercy on him, really advised that I wouldn't be pressing on top of charges. I really just want peace for y'all for the day. I told him he's welcome at school the next day because she was also frustrated that he thought she'd be suspended and the consequences of him being suspended and or expelled, right, would mean more challenges for her because she got to go to work. But I told him, no, he's welcome at school the next day. And he was even blown away because it meant that there was surely going to be a deeper problem at home. But it had long been my stance to not remove children from school for, you know, behavior that isn't particularly dangerous to them or someone else. That was the other incident where I had to go get my laptop.
We need more teachers like you, bro. Listen, man, it's such an enlightening experience connecting with you. Like I said, like, you know, you got me rethinking how thinking is done. You know what I mean? Like, you got me thinking about education and our kids. And I think that, like, man, if we can really get a lot more teachers like you out there to teach our kids and educate our kids, I think that we would be in a much better situation. I could talk to you all day, but bro, unfortunately, this thing has to come to a close. But before I let you go, tell the people how they can get in contact with you and anything you got going on.
I want to say thank you for having me on the show. Thank you for the work that you're doing, Mike Africa Jr., man. Thank you for the love that you show. Folks can find me online at Kariga Bailey. That's K-A-R-E-G-A-B-A-I-L-E-Y. Notice I said Kariga. If you say Karega, Karenga, we don't know each other, and that's cool. My name is Kariga Bailey. You can find me on all spaces at Kariga Bailey. Big up Philly and amazing work y'all doing there. Just as a quick note, I taught at Richard Wright, I think middle school, for like 8 weeks in the summer out there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so big ups.
We're going to talk about that one. We're going to talk about that one the next time you come through. And we got to talk about the Erykah Badu concert, bro.
Oh, yeah.
Congratulations on that. Thank you for coming.
New music on the way.
New music on the way. Tell us about that new music real quick.
You can follow me online at Kariga Bailey. All the music is posted there. Your album is done. The album is done. It is on the way. We got a single coming up. Yeah, just stay on the lookout, man. Got some really beautiful, beautiful music.
And make sure y'all check out Soul Affirmations right here on the Black Love Podcast Network. All right, folks, that's the wrap. Thank you for listening. Kariga, thanks for coming through. If you like what you heard, tell a friend and get them on the move with us. Leave us a review and give us the 5 stars because we need to get this thing moving. Make sure you follow the podcast so you never miss an episode drop. Till next week, peace out.
Peace out.
On the Move with Mike Africa Jr. is executive produced by me, Mike Africa Jr., and Tommy Oliver. Produced by Crystal Hill, edited by Masu McLemore, and made for you, the people.